Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Thursday, April 23rd, and this is the Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, a packed one as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex, ready to unpack the forces reshaping our world. It feels like we're constantly refining, constantly alloying the raw ore of information into something stronger, more usable. Today, we're diving into that process, forging clarity from complexity.
Let's start with AI. Is the coming wave of automation a rising tide lifting all boats, or will it exacerbate existing inequalities? We'll be looking at the skills gap, productivity gains, and the real-world impact on jobs.
Stepping back, then we shift gears to the Middle East. Oil prices, shifting alliances, what's really driving the geopolitical energy landscape? And speaking of power plays, Maya, did you see Google's latest compute infrastructure announcement?
I did. It's aggressive, to say the least. But competition isn't the only thing to watch. Security concerns are escalating fast. From there, we'll untangle the web of DeFi, security breaches, incoming regulation, and the very real risks investors are facing.
And finally, we'll look back to move forward, examining how past conflicts have reshaped the global macroeconomy and the enormous cost of reconstruction.
It's a huge day, so let's get started. 66%. That's the percentage of workers in the top 10% income bracket using AI right now, compared to just 15% in the bottom 10%. Let's talk about AI's economic impact, specifically the skills gap, productivity, and how we're building a two-tiered economy.
That disparity is striking, and it's not merely about access to technology, but a self-reinforcing cycle. Higher-income earners are typically in roles that benefit most from AI tools. Think data analysis, coding, financial modeling, creating more demand for those skills and widening the gap further. It isn't just that they have the tools, it's that their work is the tools and the value compounds.
So AI is leveling the playing field within workplaces, apparently. John Byed Murdoch pointed that out. But Focal Data's survey seems to indicate it's simultaneously tilting the entire field downhill for anyone not already on top.
There's a signal here, the workplace leveling effect is real, in that a junior analyst with AI assistance can now produce work comparable to a mid-level analyst without it. But that doesn't create new mid-level analysts. It means fewer junior and mid-level positions overall, with a disproportionate benefit accruing to the high-status knowledge workers who manage the AI and interpret the results. We're seeing a shift from human capital being the primary driver of value to human capital plus AI proficiency.
That's disconcerting. Americans seem more enthusiastic about AI integration than the British, even across comparable sectors. What's going on there?
It's likely a combination of factors, a more risk-tolerant tech culture perhaps, and a greater emphasis on efficiency in American corporate structures. But more importantly, American firms appear to be adopting AI faster to address existing labor shortages. This creates an immediate, visible benefit, even if the long-term consequences are unevenly distributed. It's a short-term fix that may exacerbate longer-term inequality.
So speed of adoption is part of the problem. And the survey data also highlights that AI isn't universally enhancing productivity.
Correct. Productivity gains are concentrated in those sectors and roles that are actively integrating AI, and even then, it's not a guaranteed outcome. There's a significant integration cost, retraining, workflow adjustments, data cleansing that many companies haven't fully accounted for. The low-hanging fruit are being picked, and the more complex implementations are revealing substantial challenges.
What about countries like the UK? Are they lagging and therefore safer or just delaying the inevitable?
I wouldn't say safer. The UK has a highly skilled workforce, but a more cautious approach to technological disruption and less immediate labor pressure driving adoption. This could allow for more thoughtful implementation and workforce planning, but it also risks falling behind in terms of overall productivity growth and competitive advantage. The longer they delay, the larger the integration cost will become.
Professor Pomerina's framing is interesting, a shift from generational thinking to a longevity society. How does that factor into the AI economic equation?
It's a critical link. A longer lifespan means a longer working life and a greater need for reskilling and upskilling throughout one's career. AI becomes less of a threat to static job categories and more of a continuous learning imperative. The demand for aging intelligence, data-driven understanding of the needs of an aging population, will only grow, and that's where the opportunities lie.
Diana Nudd distinguishes between the silver economy and the longevity economy. What's the difference and why should investors care?
The silver economy focuses on needs in old age, healthcare, assisted living, etc. The longevity economy prioritizes proactive strategies for extending health span and improving quality of life, preventative wellness, personalized medicine, financial planning for a longer lifespan. Investors should focus on the latter, as it represents a much larger and more dynamic market. It's about maximizing life, not just extending years.
So it's not just about treating diseases, but preventing them.
Precisely, 80% of non-communicable diseases are preventable, according to the data, and AI is the key to unlocking that potential. Personalized healthcare, combining genomics, medical records, and lifestyle data to predict risk and manage health proactively, is where the real value lies. And that extends far beyond traditional pharma and diagnostics. Look at GLP-1 therapies, they're not just weight loss drugs, they're paradigm shifts in managing aging as a long-term process.
This sounds expensive.
It is initially. But the cost of inaction, the burden on healthcare systems, the lost productivity is far greater. We're seeing a transition from sick care to a proactive life model, and that requires investment in preventative strategies across all industries. It's about shifting the focus from reactive treatment to predictive maintenance, and AI is the core technology enabling that shift.
Europe's innovation engine, particularly the UK and Switzerland, seems underappreciated in this space.
Europe has a unique strength in linking academic research to commercialization, especially in areas like oncology and cardiometabolic health. Beyond healthcare, there's significant growth potential in consumer-focused areas, food, nutrition, leisure, and senior living. Investors are often focused on the US market, overlooking the substantial opportunities in Europe's aging demographics.
Let's pivot to how the market itself is allocating capital. Barry Ritholtz and Rob Arnott were talking about the risks of cap-weighted indexes.
That's crucial context here. Cap-weighted indexing inherently buys high and sells low, adding stocks after significant price increases and removing them after substantial declines. It's a momentum-based strategy masquerading as passivity. And with a 5% annual turnover rate, it's far more active than most investors realize.
Hidden costs, approximately 15 basis points annually just from rebalancing.
Something to flag here, and 28% of stocks added to the S&P 500 are dropped within 10 years, highlighting the constant churn. Arnott characterized it as a flip-flop process, a systematic anomaly that costs investors money. It's all driven by the concentration in a few large stocks, the Magnificent Seven, and their outsized influence on index performance.
So what's the alternative? Fundamental indexing.
Yes, RAFI weighting companies based on economic footprint rather than market capitalization. It provides a natural value tilt, automatically downweighting expensive growth stocks and upweighting undervalued ones. Historically, it's outperformed cap-weighted value indexes by 2 to 2.5% per year compounded, with comparable tracking error.
But that sounds counterintuitive. Why would buying less of what's going up and more of what's going down be a good idea?
Because it's buying into underlying economic reality, not just price momentum. It's about identifying companies with strong fundamentals, sales, profits, cash flow, regardless of their current market valuation. It's a longer-term perspective that avoids the trap of chasing hype and overvalued assets. Essentially, AI can amplify these imbalances, making the cap-weighted trap even harder to avoid.
Farallon Capital's Nicholas Giuk is also thinking about idiosyncratic opportunities. Where are they seeing the most potential right now?
Japan equities, driven by governance changes in the biotech sector. But he's also keenly aware of the macroeconomic and geopolitical risks and actively allocates capital accordingly. However, a core theme is AI's potential to enhance investment processes across all industries, which ties directly into our current discussion.
He anticipates increased losses in private credit, particularly in software.
Why?
Overleveraged, asset-light businesses with weak fundamentals. It's a classic credit cycle dynamic, but exacerbated by the rapid growth of private credit in recent years. Giuk predicts a prolonged cycle of disruptions and opportunities beginning in 2027, focused on restructuring underperforming balance sheets.
Balaji Srinivasan is predicting a verifiability crisis in online content, driven by AI. He says the cost of faking information is approaching zero.
This is where everything converges. AI isn't creating information, it's destroying trust. The ability to generate fake resumes, emails, even videos, is eroding the foundations of online communication. The solution, according to Srinivasan, lies in cryptographically provable data and a shift towards deterministic trust, warm introductions, and direct relationships. Think of it this way, AI is breaking the encryption of reality, and we need new cryptographic methods to restore it.
So blockchain, digitally signed letters of reference.
The pattern is clear, moving beyond simple checks to a paradigm where authenticity is mathematically verified. On-chain data becoming the ledger of record for truth, enabling AI to generate unbiased narratives directly from verifiable sources. Imagine a decentralized layer of facts underpinning all reporting, allowing users to customize the information they see based on their preferences.
He frames the NYT's struggles not as a failure of credibility, but as a strategic choice, prioritizing a loyal, ideologically aligned subscriber base.
It's a brilliant framing, losing influence over the center in exchange for guaranteed readership. It highlights the economic incentives driving media polarization and the vulnerability of centralized platforms to corruption. and it reinforces the need for cryptographically secure alternatives, a hardened Web3 architecture based on verified digital signatures.
And a massive market for proctoring and identity verification services. Because if everything can be faked, someone has to verify it.
Consider this: AI lowers the cost of generation, which drives demand for verification. KYC processes, biometric identification technologies that verify unique human identity, these will become essential services. The underlying principle is simple: trust the math, not the source.
How else framing of financial markets is also relevant. It's not central bank policy, but real economy appetite for working capital-driving movements.
It's a nuanced perspective. Liquidity isn't about QE-driven duration supply. It's about the balance sheet capacity of credit providers. The U.S. Treasury shifting stimulus to Treasury QE, bank monetization of fiscal spending, is intentionally sucking liquidity out of the financial sector, flattening yield curves and creating a countercyclical relationship with the real economy.
Okay, so what does all of this mean? The biggest implication for our listeners.
The concentration of economic power and access to AI will continue to intensify. Those who control the data, the AI infrastructure, and the verification mechanisms will win. Those who rely on centralized platforms and outdated trust models will lose. The real crisis isn't the creation of fake information. It's the collapse of shared reality, and that's a much more fundamental break.
And the resulting geopolitical instability, that's where things get really interesting. Considering the shift to verification and the economic implications of secure, decentralized data, we need to discuss the Middle East and global oil. You know what I noticed this week? My gas station loyalty card suddenly feels inadequate. It's a geopolitical risk mitigation tool now, apparently.
It's a surprisingly apt observation. We're past the point of simply viewing energy security as a matter of convenience or price. The recent escalation with Iran has fundamentally reshaped the landscape, and the interconnectedness that Daniel Yergin highlights is the key. It's not just about oil, but helium, fertilizers, even sovereign wealth funds.
Interconnectedness. Right? Because if you're going to weaponize a choke point, you might as well throw in petrochemicals while you're at it.
So here's the picture: that wider economic integration, as Yergin pointed out, amplifies the shock. The traditional view of resilience versus vulnerability isn't sufficient. The U.S., with its shale production and internal spending, is buffered. Asia, reliant on 80% of its oil and 90% of its LNG through the Strait of Hormuz, isn't. East Africa, disrupted jet fuel supplies. It's drastically differentiated.
The U.S. gets to watch the fireworks from a relatively comfortable position.
Largely, yes. U.S. energy independence, evidenced by record exports, the EIA data confirms this, gives it significant leverage. The market's sensitivity to U.S.-Iran developments reflects this underlying assumption of avoidability of large-scale escalation, but the risk-off behavior would be immediate.
Immediate risk-off? As in, the market would reverse on a fake tweet?
We can trace that further. Doug Krisner and the team observed that, demonstrated by the rapid market swings following unconfirmed reports. It speaks to the underlying fear of a major disruption.
Let's talk about the disruption itself. Iran's strategy from the material seems pretty straightforward. Control the Strait of Hormuz, create a deterrent, and extend the conflict into the global economy.
It's a calculated maneuver. Leveraging the energy crisis as economic warfare, effectively weaponizing control of that choke point. And it's working at least to a degree, forcing a reassessment of strategic priorities, namely diversifying all sources.
Diversifying. Guyana, Brazil, U.S. shale. It feels obvious.
It is obvious, but implementation is complex. The urgency is heightened. And beyond production, it's about infrastructure to bypass the Strait of Hormuz.
And who's benefiting from all this obviousness? Besides, you know, anyone not dependent on Iranian goodwill.
China is the clear beneficiary and increasingly the problem. They're purchasing 80 to 90% of Iranian oil, even reporting zero crude imports officially. It's a shadow fleet of over 500 ships keeping that flow alive, despite the U.S. naval blockade.
A shadow fleet? That sounds delightfully illegal.
It's a well-oiled network, as Knutson and Jones detailed, front companies, teapots in Shandong province, shadow banking. The government is increasing quotas for those refineries to import Iranian oil.
Okay, so China's basically running a sanctions-busting operation in plain sight. And what's the U.S. doing about it?
Applying maximum pressure, indicting individuals and companies attempting to disrupt the fleet. But it's proving remarkably resilient. Rory Jones frames it as part of a broader shift away from the U.S.-led financial system.
A broader shift? As in, Iran's oil sales are a symptom of an anti-US bloc establishing independent systems.
It's a telling detail. A challenge to the dollar's dominance. And the shadow fleet operates through barter systems, directly paying Chinese construction companies for infrastructure projects, bypassing traditional financial channels.
So less money flowing through SWIFT, more construction in Iran. What's the U.S. leverage point here?
The U.S. can disrupt the fleet, but the sheer scale, over 1,000 aging ships globally, and opaque ownership structures make complete eradication improbable. The network's resilience suggests economic pressure alone is insufficient.
Which brings us back to China's long game. They're stockpiling resources, creating self-reliance. Yurgen frames it as a model Western nations may need to emulate, despite current inventory depletion.
Correct. China's strategy is driven by vulnerability and reflects a broader security policy prioritizing self-reliance. They're learning from energy shocks that Western nations are still reacting to.
Let's talk about price signals. The material contrasts a financial market responding to geopolitical statements with a physical market reacting to actual supply dislocations.
Yurgen noted this gap during the March crisis. The industry perceived genuine logistical chaos, while financial markets anticipated a swift resolution. Brent futures versus dated Brent, two divergent signals.
A disconnect between perception and reality. And this perception is what? That the strait stays open.
Largely, yes. And this underpricing of supply disruption, 13 million barrels a day offline, suggests a potential for much larger price shocks than the market currently anticipates, as ING's Patterson pointed out.
Which, if I'm understanding correctly, means we're not nearly panicked enough yet.
And this is where AI factors in. AI's growing energy demands are driving renewed interest in nuclear power, placing substantial new requirements on electricity grids.
Because suddenly building a data center requires geopolitical risk assessment.
The implication runs deeper. It's forcing tech firms to become direct players in the energy sector, investing in and building capacity. This is redefining energy security, shifting the focus from oil and gas to electricity.
This is escalating quickly. We've gone from loyalty cards to nuclear power plants in, what, 5 minutes?
The pace of change is accelerating. And it's not just about demand. Drones have emerged as a game-changing technology, empowering smaller actors and raising concerns about a new era of warfare.
Drones? Ukraine's capabilities enabling control of strategic choke points. Yurgen points out Iran's recent success in controlling the strait, despite facing a superior military force.
The closure of the Strait of Hormuz was enabled by Iran's drone capabilities, which is a shift in asymmetric warfare tactics. It's a beta test for a new era of warfare echoing the Spanish Civil War.
Okay, so the drones are the problem. Beyond the obvious.
The problem isn't just the drones themselves, but the fact that they've proven so effective. Yurgen notes the optimism around Gulf investment in early 2026 is now tempered by the proven capability of cheap drones like the Shahid to disrupt energy flows.
The perception of efficiency-driven global supply chains is being reversed. Security, predictability, and resilience become paramount. Sovereign wealth fund allocation to defense increases. Makes sense.
Two things stand out. And the Ukraine conflict is providing other nations cards in dealing with drone warfare, specifically expertise to protect against attacks. Gulf states are receiving training.
Ukraine is indirectly benefiting from its own disruption.
It's an unexpected consequence. And this crisis is creating a crisis for NATO, resurfacing internal tensions.
Greenland, right. Yurgen mentioned that.
Worth noting, a potential realignment driven by energy and security. The inherent difficulty in restoring oil market balance after disruptions, even with a ceasefire, is underestimated.
A minimum recovery period of several months. Petrochemical production normalizing in 2/3 of a year. That's not exactly a quick fix.
Correct. And the resurgence of ESG investing, rebranded under the umbrellas of energy security and AI electrification.
Saving the planet now comes with a security clause.
Essentially, tech companies will continue investing in renewables while acknowledging gas usage, reframing these investments as infrastructure projects. The historical continuity of Iranian influence, dating back to 1908, underscores its enduring ability to exert control.
Iran's been mastering this game for a long time, even if the players have changed.
Yurgen highlights a 47-year brewing conflict and the consistency of Iran's strategic importance.
Okay, let's make a bet. By December 31st, 2026, Brent futures will exceed $110 a barrel, and Lufthansa will reinstate a fuel surcharge on all long-haul flights.
I'll take that bet. I think the market is underestimating the extent of the disruption. And Lufthansa, given their reliance on jet fuel, is particularly vulnerable.
Good. Now let's talk about Google's AI ambitions. Because if everyone's building their own power plants, someone needs to design the algorithms that optimize them. We were just talking about the concentration of power in cloud infrastructure, and I'm increasingly convinced Google is making a very deliberate play to own the entire AI stack. It feels different than AWS or Microsoft's approaches.
The data tells a story. While the others focus heavily on training models, Google is prioritizing inference, which now dominates AI production costs. Their TPU 8i chip and the ability to scale to over a million of them is a structural advantage, even if Gemini isn't currently topping every benchmark.
A million TPUs. That's a lot of chips.
It is, and it's historically been a bottleneck that NVIDIA struggled with. This focus on inference allows Google to offer cheaper options, attracting frontier AI labs like Thinking Machine Labs, and crucially, positioning themselves as neutral hosting for competitors like Anthropic.
Speaking of Anthropic, their restricted proprietary release model for Mythos seems risky, giving a cybersecurity AI only to companies with high reputational risk, like Apple and Google, feels like a temporary fix, and it's already backfired with a breach due to predictable URLs.
Worth noting that security incident caused by credential leaks through a contractor underscores a broader vulnerability, weaknesses in vendor access control. The Mythos situation highlighted that security isn't necessarily about model exploits, but about protecting access points, something every enterprise adopting AI needs to urgently audit. It's an incredibly fragile architecture.
Sebastian Malaby mentioned the UK losing AI talent to the US following the DeepMind acquisition. Does Google's strategy actively incentivize that, drawing labs and researchers to its cloud platform?
It's a strong possibility. By becoming the go-to infrastructure provider, particularly through these compute deals, they're effectively centralizing talent. Microsoft's bundling of Azure OpenAI with Copilot mirrors this, creating distribution networks where Google's Chrome integration offers a more direct channel to Fortune 500 accounts.
Gemini trailing GPT-5.4 and Claude Opus 4.7, that feels less important with this three-layer approach, though. Silicon, compute, and the agent layer within Chrome.
Google is building a full-stack solution agnostic to the winning model, prioritizing customer choice and market access. They're not solely focused on leaderboard rankings, but on seamless integration and cost-effectiveness, anticipating enterprise customers will prioritize those factors, as demonstrated by Infosys' success integrating ChatGPT.
So the success hinges on independent validation of those TPU benchmarks and continuing to pull frontier labs onto Google Cloud. One additional lab joining could be a real structural shift. But what keeps me up at night is Anthropic's IPO in October. If they gain enough independence,
it introduces another powerful competitor with a radically different safety philosophy, potentially accelerating AGI development with Dury Amodai's prediction of arrival within 3 years. And given their current trajectory and unique release model, they could become increasingly difficult to integrate into Google's ecosystem, creating real geopolitical friction around AI access and control.
This access point friction feels like a particularly relevant risk, given the broader blockchain conversation we'll be jumping into next, and how that tech is also fundamentally about controlling access. 30%. That's the estimated annual premium for DeFi insurance, according to Austin Campbell. Let's unpack that. We're diving into the evolving security landscape of decentralized finance today, a landscape that's proving far more treacherous than initially believed.
Stepping back, that 30% figure isn't just a high cost, it's an admission that current risk assessment is finally getting real. Capital rotation is happening, shifting away from opaque private credit into alternatives like yield-bearing stablecoins, Apex USD being a prime example, but security vulnerabilities are the choke point and those premiums reflect it.
So the dream of frictionless finance runs headfirst into the reality of infrastructure-level attacks. It sounds less like coding errors and more like nation-state actors messing with RPC nodes.
Two things stand out. Michael Bentley identifies a fundamental shift, moving beyond solely smart contract exploits toward key leaks and RPC node compromises. We're talking about attacks that are harder to detect, less transparent, and potentially orchestrated with a level of sophistication that previous anti-fragility arguments didn't account for. Help DAO's 46-minute response time, while preventing total loss, underscores the speed imperative.
46 minutes feels leisurely for a crisis. Though Chris Perkins points out that even imperfectly fast responses are valuable. Are we saying speed is security now?
Not speed is security, but security is fundamentally about speed of response. But the bigger issue is the foundational assumption that DeFi transactions are inherently legitimate. Austin Campbell suggests we need a paradigm shift, moving toward skepticism as the default, potentially introducing voting requirements for large transactions.
Skepticism as the default, so less trustless and more constantly suspicious. That's a pretty dramatic reevaluation.
It is.
And it dovetails with the growing realization that achieving true immutability in lending protocols is not possible due to external dependencies. The features that provide liquidity, easy deposits, and withdrawals inherently create systemic risk, as we've seen in recent crises.
That's bleak. Is centralization then inevitable?
Michael Bentley frames it as minimizing the minimum amount of centralizing force needed for stability. The softening regulatory stance, surprisingly, could allow for things previously considered unacceptable: robust auditing, AI integration, more control and monitoring. Fight AI with AI approach, as they put it, is now essential given Mythos AI's ability to find vulnerabilities in established codebases like BSD Linux.
AI identifying flaws in BSD Linux. You're suggesting the entire security landscape is democratizing and not necessarily in a good way.
Something to flag here, the accessibility of those tools to both attackers and defenders. Which brings us back to that 30% insurance premium and decentralized risk-sharing pools. Chris Perkins described those pools, membership benefits from protocol yield but bears the cost of hacks. It's complex, rife with trust assumptions, and expensive.
So we've arrived at a future where DeFi protocols are either insured at prohibitive costs or reliant on risk pools with undefined units and potentially fatal flaws. The fundamental question this entire discussion hasn't answered is, if true decentralization is incompatible with robust security, what does a sustainable DeFi ecosystem even look like?
That's a critical gap. It's not about technological perfection, it's about defining the acceptable level of centralization. But ultimately, the sustainability question relies on how we address these inherent trade-offs and potentially reassess the speed of transactions as a core feature, given its associated security risks. And perhaps that will inform our next discussion on the macro fallout of past conflicts and the funding of reconstruction.
The Gulf War's economic hangover is still apparently a thing. UBS is calling it a long-term question, which translated means we have no idea when this mess will be sorted. What's the biggest tension point here, Alex? Is it the reconstruction itself, or who's footing the bill?
It's definitively the funding, Maya. The source material from Chief Economist Lane highlights that the full economic effects are years away, but the immediate issue is reconstruction funding and the geopolitical competition it's sparking. The Gulf countries requesting dollar swap lines isn't a sign of strength. It's a potential indicator of having to liquidate sovereign wealth fund assets prematurely, potentially at unfavorable rates.
Liquidate sovereign wealth fund assets? Right. Basically sell the family silver to pay for things. And the US and China are eyeing that silver, aren't they?
Consider this, Paul Donovan's analysis points directly to a rivalry for influence, where the US and China will be competing for contracts, and by extension, long-term regional leverage. The ultimate impact will depend on where the money goes. If it flows to US companies and services, the dollar strengthens. If diverted elsewhere, we'll see FX movements favoring European, UK, and Asian economies.
FX movements. So the future value of our lattes is tied to who rebuilds a power plant in Kuwait.
Oversimplified, but fundamentally, yes. Consider the implications through a macro lens. The Gulf War funding isn't just about oil infrastructure. It's about solidifying geopolitical alliances and the broader currency landscape. We're already seeing the pressure on dollar liquidity reflected in these swap line requests.
And AI and blockchain, where do they fit into this scramble for reconstruction dollars?
That's the interesting pivot. AI could be a significant factor in reconstruction efficiency, with smart contracts automating project management and reducing corruption, potentially attractive to Gulf states seeking transparency. Blockchain could also provide secure and auditable supply chains, incentivizing investment. But that's contingent on regulatory frameworks and adoption rates.
Regulatory frameworks. Another euphemism. Meaning political battles and bureaucratic delays. So let's say China starts offering AI-powered reconstruction packages.
That would directly challenge US influence. If China secures a substantial portion of reconstruction contracts and utilizes their digital infrastructure, we could see a shift in regional financial power away from the dollar. This isn't just about immediate reconstruction costs, it's about establishing long-term technological dependencies.
Dependencies. Okay. So what's one specific thing to watch between now and, say, December 31st of this year?
The allocation of major reconstruction contracts in Iraq. Specifically, monitor the companies awarded key infrastructure projects. Any significant wins by Chinese firms, particularly those with strong AI and blockchain capabilities, would signal a clear shift in the geopolitical balance and likely result in downward pressure on the dollar by January 1, 2025.
Pulling back from the specifics, AI tools in the hands of the top 10% energy choke points, DeFi insurance rates hovering around 30%, reconstruction bids going to Beijing, it feels like we've been mapping a single accelerating dynamic today. The story isn't about isolated events, it's about the widening gap between those who can leverage systemic advantages and those who can't. We talked about how AI isn't lifting all boats, but actively redesigning the fleet, and only those with the resources to retrofit are staying afloat.
The implication runs deeper, that retrofit requires not just capital but foresight. The 66% AI adoption rate in the top income bracket isn't accidental. It's a manifestation of pre-existing networks, access to education, and frankly, the time to experiment. The macro implications are profound. We're seeing value creation increasingly concentrated in these augmented human capitals, creating a self-reinforcing loop. the 5% annual turnover in cap-weighted indexes, the 28% drop rate of S&P 500 newcomers, these aren't random fluctuations. They suggest a market rewarding agility and punishing inertia.
And that agility is increasingly tied to geopolitical positioning, isn't it? 80% of Asia's oil flowing through the Strait of Hormuz creates an inherent vulnerability, one China is acutely aware of and actively exploiting. The reconstruction funds in Iraq, where those contracts land, is less about rebuilding and more about rebuilding influence. It's economic statecraft playing out in real time.
And that's where the friction with DeFi comes into play. The appeal of a ledger of record independent of national actors is clear, but the 46-minute response time of KelpDAO to a security incident underlines a fundamental trade-off. Speed and immutability often come at the cost of robust oversight. It's a bit like, well, it's akin to a complex circulatory system where the capillaries are incredibly fast, but vulnerable to blockages. The body of the global economy needs both rapid flow and reliable checks.
So we have this tension, a global system rewarding concentration of power, accelerated by AI and fueled by strategic resource control, while simultaneously seeing a burgeoning ecosystem trying to bypass traditional gatekeepers, but struggling with inherent security flaws. Is it possible to build a resilient system where 15% AI adoption in the bottom 10% doesn't become a permanent fixture?
That's the million-dollar question. The 2 to 2.5% outperformance of RAFI indexes hints at the power of broad-based value investing, but even that requires consistent, deliberate allocation. Watching the outcome of those Iraqi reconstruction contracts is paramount. Significant Chinese wins would signal a clear downward pressure on the dollar. We anticipate Brent futures exceeding $110 by December 2026 and Lufthansa reinstating fuel surcharges. These aren't isolated predictions, they're symptoms of a system under strain.
And that makes the unaddressed question of decentralized security all the more critical. Can we truly have deterministic trust without a minimum amount of centralizing force?
The answer, as always, is complicated.
Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow digging deeper.